What's on your mind right now? The song you can't get out of your head? That breaking story? Or that conversation you just have to be a part of?
That's the brand new song from...
This is a breaking news report.
He shoots! He scores!
That's radio. Happening now. Connecting you to what matters most exactly when it's happening. From the airwaves to every device you stream on, radio is everywhere you are. It's local, live, and it's for you. Tag your favorite radio station tomorrow on social media and use hashtag National Radio Day to celebrate. That's hashtag National Radio Day.
Welcome back, folks. Whenever a leader of a political subdivision ultimately ends up getting indicted, whether it's the state or the Fed, the landscape kind of changes. A lot changes. The culture, the attitude of that area changes. Here to talk to us about it is Ron Fauché, political analyst and publisher of Lunchtime Politics. Ron, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Happy to be here.
Ron, your thoughts about my opening statement. What changes?
Well, you know, anytime there is a possibility that a public official may have to go to prison, it changes how people see that public official. And it doesn't necessarily mean the politics change so much. We saw Donald Trump, for example, indicted four separate times, and it had, you know, received enormous press coverage. But every time he was indicted, he actually improved his standing among Republican primary voters for president. And so it didn't necessarily change where things were going into that, but it certainly changed attitudes about everything. We saw that when Edwin Edwards, when he was governor, I believe in his third term, was indicted and was not convicted. And of course that, you know, the same kind of thing. People look at the official differently because they don't know where they're going to end up. And that was the case there, although he continued to be governor. And he came back and was elected to a fourth term after that. So sometimes the impact on the elected officials is not as great as you might think. But I think you make a good case that it does change the situation. And it changes how people look at that politician, and it affects how people govern after that. And there was a headline in the newspaper the other day saying Mayor Cantrell has become the lamest of lame ducks, and I think that's correct. You know, in the last, you know, 4, 5, 6 months of anybody's term, they do become a lame duck. And if they're indicted on top of that, it makes it even worse.
One would have to admit, though, in the case of both, you make good points, in the case of both Donald Trump and Edwin Edwards, two political figures almost bigger than life, right?
Absolutely. And you know, both of them did a lot, you know, and they had, they were very active over long periods of time. And they were extremely well known. In the case of the mayor here, you know, for a long time, she polled very well. You know, she was polling, her positive ratings were over 70%, then they went into the 60s, then they went into the 40s, and then they went into the 30s. And for the last year or so, they've been in the 20s. So her public standing, and political standing has over time weakened, and so there wasn't a whole lot left there, and of course something like this makes it very difficult for her to do anything or get much accomplished, because she has her you know, the time she's spending is going to have to be spent defending herself as well as what she's doing as mayor, and of course we've got an election going on and a new mayor coming up, and so, you know, it's you know, effectively she sort of checked out unless there's some big issue or something that emerges that she can jump on or champion. So that's really kind of it, and you know, the people of the city get a chance to vote, in a couple of months. They don't get to vote on her because she's not running for anything. But, you know, the politicians in the city are all asking one another, you know, how will this affect the mayor's race and the council races? And will it increase turnout? Will it help one particular candidate over another? Of course, we don't know that yet, because when you look at polling, you know, isn't going to show the true effects of something like this for a while. It's going to take a while for those effects to be pollable, but they all go into the public mind and affect how the public ultimately is going to look at this.
On the text line this morning, Ron, most people are asking why the political power base, so to speak, all of the elected officials are not asking for her resignation. They feel like, you know, we've had people saying we feel like we've been abused. Obviously, the indictment kind of brands the abuse. Why is no one asking for the resignation?
I think the answer is because she's leaving office in January, no matter what. And so people feel like that, you know, that's going to be coming around the block pretty quickly. You elect a new mayor in October or November. The attention is going to turn to that. The new mayor is going to need some time for a transition. So I think a lot of people feel like it just may not make a whole lot of difference one way or another. And of course, you know, there's always the possibility that she could resign. Maybe there's some kind of a plea deal that could be made. I have no idea whether something like that is possible. I'm not on the inside of any of this, so I just don't know. But sometimes that does happen in these political situations. So we really don't know. But you're right. There isn't anybody calling for her resignation. And under the law, she doesn't have to resign. You know, you're innocent until you're proven guilty. And now look, if she was at the beginning of her second term instead of the end, it probably would be a different story.
Yeah. The long list of individuals, right, that have been indicted and convicted, and some indicted and found innocent throughout the metro area. There was a piece by Ben Myers in NOLA.com the other day listing them. A lot of folks are saying that they believe that this is possibly racially motivated. Your thoughts?
Well, I mean, I have no reason to believe that it is. I mean, and let's hope something like that isn't racially motivated. I mean, justice should be equal, and it should apply to everybody the same way. So let's hope that's the case. And I don't know that there's any reason to think that. The U.S. attorney had been looking at this case for a long time. They collected a lot of information, a lot of facts, a lot of evidence, and they made a decision on it, and that's where it stands.
What are you hearing in the political circles about this happenstance? It, you know, a lot of people asked me over the weekend. I said, well, everyone's kind of been waiting for a year now for this hammer to drop. In fact, you know, more people than not are saying, not a question of if, but when, and or have been surprised by the delay.
Well, I think that is true. There's been rumors galore for a long time about this happening. And there's been news stories about, you know, certain things happening with the investigation. I know it had gotten to the point that every Thursday and Friday afternoon, people were saying, oh, it's going to finally happen. It's going to finally happen. And then it never did. So the actual indictment, I think, caught some people off guard because they were expecting it a week or two before, and it didn't happen. So I do think it was expected by a lot of people, and wasn't any major surprise. But on the other hand, I think that there was a sense on the part of a lot of political people that it wouldn't happen. If it did happen, it wouldn't happen while she was still in office. And I think a lot of people came to the conclusion, well, you know, if it hasn't happened already, it's probably not going to happen. So there's been an awful lot of speculation. And of course, the speculation, as always, proves pretty much irrelevant. And these prosecutors move when they want to, and that's what they came up with.
Not that I want to engage in conjecture, but, you know, I had a conversation this morning with someone, and the question was asked of me, Newell, if she announced that she was going on another one of these climate conference trips, what do you think would happen? I was like, I think people would go crazy. If she did, but it wouldn't surprise me, to be quite honest with you.
who knows? I mean, you know, she is now in a legal situation. There's going to have to be an arraignment, and there are certain rules, of course, that apply. And I don't know whether her ability to travel will be limited or not. But who knows what'll happen? But I do think the people of the city got tired of all of these trips that didn't seem to make much difference. It didn't seem that much came out of it, out of these trips. It wasn't like you were going to some specific thing to do something specific, and then you come back with a benefit for the city. So I think all of that has hurt her over time, And as you said, a lot of people wouldn't be surprised if she did that. I'm not saying she would or whatever, but you know that's where it is.
Yeah. Final thoughts, Ron?
Well, you know, it's the beginning of a new chapter for her. Nobody wants to see anybody have to go through that process. But
no, you're right.
But on the other side of the coin, there was a lot there that was done wrong. I mean, it's up to a jury to figure out whether what was done was just wrong, whether it was criminal. But there clearly were things that were wrong, and I do think it will enhance the issue of political corruption in this particular campaign for mayor and for the city council and for all the races, for that matter. Because it puts political corruption sort of back on the map as a current issue.
Yeah, I think questions will certainly be asked. Let me pivot real quick, if you don't mind. Recent poll, I think it was released either yesterday or this morning. Helena Moreno still holds on at 47%. Royce Duplessis has jumped in front of Oliver Thomas by 2 points. Your thoughts?
Well, I conducted that poll for WWL-TV,
yes.
And basically what it shows is that over the last few weeks, Moreno's vote and Thomas's vote has stayed just a bunch the same. And Duplessis was the one candidate who moved up. Now, he moved up from third place to second place. He was 2 points behind Thomas a few weeks ago. Now he's a couple of points ahead of Thomas. And I do think his movement reflected the getting out of the race of Judge Arthur Hunter and Hunter's endorsement of him. I do think, you know, we talk about endorsements. Sometimes they have more effect than others. I think Hunter's endorsement of Duplessis was effective. I think it was helpful for Duplessis, and it's put him in second place. You know, he's just got in this race, close to less than 2 months, 6 weeks ago, whatever it was. And he's now overtaken the second place runner and is in second place. So that's certainly progress, but this campaign has yet to really get going, and even though voters are picking candidates, most of the voters, over 80%, pretty much know who they want to vote for. But on the other side of the coin, there's a lot that has to happen. There's going to be televised debates coming up. They still haven't really started to attack one another to the extent that that you know they will between now and election day. And so we don't know any of that, what's happening. But as it stands now, the, you know, Moreno is by far the, you know, the strongest candidate. You know, she's number one in vote. She has a strong favorable rating. And the other candidates have a long way to go to catch her. Now they feel that if either Duplessis or Thomas gets in the runoff with her, it's a new race and maybe something can happen. But so it's an interesting contest, and I think the people in the city are getting increasingly interested in it. So we'll see what that means.
You know, these races that end up in a second primary with one candidate at 47, 48, or 49, and another one in the 20, you know, in some other number, they don't typically bode well for the underdog, right? I mean, there have been some anomaly outcomes along those lines. But what's been interesting to me, and I wonder whether or not you anticipated whether or not there would be a 1 or 2 point loss of the base of Helena Moreno at 47 with the margin of error, she could have a majority of the vote as she sits there right now.
Yes, that's certainly possible. And we don't fully know who's going to vote. The turnout in New Orleans citywide elections have been very low in recent elections. And if the turnout jumps up, it can have a big effect on which one of these candidates, has movement at the end. But it's very difficult to poll when somebody is right under 50. It's very difficult to predict, I should say. It's easy to poll it, but it's very difficult to predict whether or not they will get that extra 3 points. I mean, you know, there's essentially 19 points that's persuadable right now. And if she picks up 3 from there, she would have her 50. But we don't know if she loses some. And we don't know what the other candidates do if they can take points off of her.
Yeah. It's going to be an interesting race for sure. And interesting to see how this indictment and I don't know how proactive the mayor is going to be in the coming months in much of anything as well. As always, Ron Fauché, political analyst and publisher of Lunchtime Politics, thank you so much for your time, your insight, and have a great week.
Thank you.
We will be right back, folks, and we'll visit with Colonel Jeff McCausland, CBS military analyst. We'll get his thoughts about the Trump-Putin-Alaskan summit and what is actually going on today in Washington, D.C., as a long list of individuals are arriving, to include French President Emmanuel Macron, Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, Finnish President Alexander Stubb, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer, German Chancellor Friedrich Merz, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, and NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte. We'll be right back.
What's on your mind right now? The song you can't get out of your head? That breaking story? Or that conversation you just have to be a part of?
That's the brand new song from...
This is a breaking news report.
He shoots! He scores!
That's radio. Happening now. Connecting you to what matters most exactly when it's happening. From the airwaves to every device you stream on, radio is everywhere you are. It's local, live, and it's for you. Tag your favorite radio station tomorrow on social media and use hashtag National Radio Day to celebrate. That's hashtag National Radio Day.
Stay with us. Folks, you will recall we visited with Colonel Jeff McCausland, CBS military analyst, leading up to the Trump-Putin-Alaskan summit, and he agreed to come back, and we have him this morning. Colonel, welcome to the show.
Neil, always a pleasure.
Colonel, very little information has leaked out other than the Russians want the Donbass, which you said that's what they wanted, and the U.S. may be willing to provide security guarantees. We're not sure what that means. I thought Ukraine had one already prior to the invasion in 2014. So where are we? And now today, European leaders visiting with Zelensky and the president in D.C. Your thoughts?
Well, where we are is, of course, coming out of this Alaskan summit. And of course, and what we saw in Alaska, I thought, was a major pivot by President Trump from what his going-in position was to what his coming-out position was. If one said who was successful at that particular summit, I'd say you'd have to say Mr. Putin was, and that's judging by the goals that both went in for. Trump at the onset said he was going to insist on an immediate ceasefire and then negotiations on a final settlement. And if the Russians didn't agree with that, there would be severe consequences. And he talked about increased tariffs and sanctions on the Russians. He talked about secondary sanctions on countries like India and China that would buy an awful lot of oil and underwrite the cost of the war in Ukraine. Well, none of that happened, and he came out of it more aligned with Mr. Putin in saying, well, I've decided what we need to do is go to an immediate final settlement, which the Russians have always talked about in the past. And coming out of the meeting, of course, in the aftermath, there was no press conference, and you're right, Newell was pretty opaque at the end. But Mr. Putin gave, I thought, a pretty important speech in which he talked about what he talked about to go in with, that the root causes have to be addressed. That's what the Russians have said since this war began. For them, the root causes really are NATO has to do a rollback, Ukraine can't join NATO, the Ukrainians have to give up these four provinces plus Ukraine, Ukrainian military has to be reduced to 85,000, a new government in Ukraine, and Ukraine has to agree that Russian is the official language of Ukraine. It's kind of a surrender. But in essence, they go away with that still pretty much intact, so I think they probably were drinking a lot of vodka on the way back to Moscow. Now we have this very important meeting today in Washington. Mr. Zelensky is coming for a bilateral meeting. In fact, he should arrive around 1 o'clock Eastern time for that meeting with the president. We have seven additional European leaders from Poland, Germany, United Kingdom, France, and Italy, as well as the European Union, to meet with Mr. Trump to try to define what the way ahead is. Because the concern, I think, now is more, not only is this the fate of Ukraine we're talking about, we're talking about the fate of NATO. And is Mr. Putin now being successful not only in getting his way with Ukraine, but in using this issue as a wedge between the United States and its European ally?
So there's been a lot of chatter about this security guarantee being something very similar to the Article 5 guarantee if you're a participating NATO member. If you would, remind the audience of this alleged guarantee that we had prior to the invasion in 2014 of Crimea. I thought there was one that everyone had agreed to. It didn't seem to come to the forefront.
Well, that's exactly right. But and what this goes back to, of course, is the NATO guarantee, Article 5, applies to NATO members, and Ukraine is not a NATO member. And that's very true. But there have been several guarantees by the Russians. Let's begin at the beginning. In 1991, when all the republics of the Soviet Union would meet in Tashkent, they would sign an agreement whereby they would become independent and they would recognize each other's borders. And the Russian Federation recognized the border of Ukraine in 1991, which included Crimea as part of Ukraine. Then in 1991 also, the Ukrainians would announce the transfer of nuclear weapons that were on the soil of Ukraine to the Russian Federation. And in return, this is called the Budapest Memorandum. In return, the United States, Russian Federation, and Great Britain guaranteed the sovereignty of Ukraine. Well, in 2014, when the Russians would invade Crimea, that didn't mean a great deal. But we have to put that, I think, a little bit in a context. And don't forget, Ukraine was in the midst of a revolution and near civil war at that time. The leader of Ukraine, who was in many ways a Russian puppet, had opposed efforts to move Ukraine closer to the European Union. That had resulted in mass social unrest in Kyiv. He fled the country, and amidst all that unrest, the Russians would, in fact, invade and occupy Crimea with no particular casualties, and they would also begin a civil war in the Donbass region, and basically that would be frozen in another agreement called the Minsk Accords in 2014, which was supposed to lead to negotiation on a final settlement. And, of course, once again in 2022, that was violated with the former. So there have been several in the past. The security guarantee has always been fundamental to the Ukrainians because of that history. Their belief is us transferring territory to the Russians doesn't mean much. It's a temporary solution. We've seen this movie before, and that would just set the stage for them to invade again. And furthermore, if they gave up the territory the Russians demand that they still occupy, they would compromise what is their primary defensive belt and put them in a militarily very inferior position to defend themselves. So that's why they want some kind of a security guarantee. Well, joining NATO would be a security guarantee, but we've taken that off the table. So it seems to be now being discussed as some kind of a security guarantee of the so-called coalition of the willing. That would include based on their presence today, at least, I would think their principal European allies, Brits, Germans, French, Italians. But the real question is, what would be the participation of the United States? Mr. Trump has had, you know, some rather vague comments about accepting some kind of security guarantee, but no idea what that means for the United States. Does that mean American soldiers in Ukraine? Does that mean the United States provides air cover, logistics, command and control? The real, you know, details are not unimportant in this particular regard. So what's odd, Newell, in a way, is we're very clear about what Vladimir Putin wants. He's made that clear. He reiterated that in Alaska. What we're unclear about is what Donald Trump wants and what Donald Trump's willing to accept.
Is there the possibility of some type of military base of the coalition of the willing being inside the territorial boundaries of Ukraine?
It's
that
certainly
would be
possible.
the most overt security guarantee one could offer, right?
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, you could end up in a ceasefire, or rather, and here the terms are not unimportant, an armistice. You know, we're in an armistice in Korea that has lasted now for some 70 years plus. U.S. forces have been in Korea to enforce that armistice for 70 plus years. So could you imagine something like that on the border to be determined between Ukraine and Russia? Perhaps. That would be, I think, something that would be of interest to the Ukrainians because, again, based on the history I described, they're obviously skeptical about, you know, things that are said that are not backed up by physical forces on the ground that underscore the deterrence value of those security guarantees to prevent or deter the Russians from future aggression.
Yeah, I mean, I like to put myself in the shoes of the president of Ukraine, and this sounds a lot like Animal House's double secret probation mentality. You know, we've been there. We've done that. We've gone through two security guarantees, and you know, I don't see any airplanes flying. I don't see any bombs dropping, and I don't see any bullets being shot. Right?
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. And unfortunately, what worries me right now is based on some of the comments the president has made, President Trump, since returning from Alaska. He seems to be putting more and more of the pressure on Mr. Zelensky to solve this. He said, well, you know, Mr. Zelensky can solve this almost immediately if he wants to. Well, that's always been true. Surrender has always been an option. But what I find odd is he doesn't say at the same time, Mr. Putin could end this with a phone call. All he's got to do is call his general, say, hey, stop attacking Ukrainians, stop sending drones over Ukrainian cities and pounding them with missiles. And that would end the war as well. But the president seems to be more and more saying it's really up to Zelensky to end this war. He's got to be the one to make concessions, which doesn't at the moment seem to be, you know, the efforts of trying to be a minimum even-handed in this particular regard or acknowledging some of those requirements that the Ukrainians clearly have.
It seems to me, and look, I don't know much about this, but if I put myself in the shoes of Donald Trump, this morning I wake up and I hear the news that the Russians are bombing Kharkiv.
Right.
My response would be, this guy just wants to embarrass the shit out of me. there can't be any other reason why, you know, he would engage and go ahead and do that this morning, knowing that all of these leaders that are ultimately going to have a play in sitting down and trying to bring about peace are coming to visit with me today. How could you read that any other way? I don't understand.
Sadly, I'm with you. I mean, even as Mr. Trump was meeting Putin in Alaska, were drones and missiles striking Ukrainian cities and killing Ukrainian civilians? Yes. Today, are drones and missiles striking Ukrainian cities and killing Ukrainian civilians? Yes. So as a consequence, that's what you'd have to believe. And this is to the guy, Mr. Putin, who you welcome very warmly. I mean, when he arrived on the tarmac, Mr. Putin, I would argue, had been successful. He had been isolated in the international community following the invasion 3.5 years ago. He's been indicted by the International Criminal Court for war crimes because of the disappearance of over 20,000 Ukrainian children that have been spirited away to Russia. And he can't go to a lot of major countries around the world because he would be arrested on the spot. The United States is not a signatory to that particular agreement. And Mr. Trump now warmly welcomes him, rolls out the red carpet, gives a flyover of military aircraft, shakes his hand, claps when he arrives, ushers him into his limousine. They drive away laughing together. And then at the end of this particular summit, Mr. Trump has done this flip-flop from the agreement that he achieved with the European leaders and Zelensky in a virtual conference that occurred last Wednesday, that the United States would insist on a ceasefire first and then be willing to negotiate anything. That was the agreed position that we had made with our European allies and Zelensky last Wednesday, and comes out of that meeting basically in agreement with Mr. Putin, and announces there has been some progress very vaguely, but goes away without anything else to show for the particular meeting. So I would have to rack and stack that as a major win for Mr. Putin at the moment, based on what both leaders had as their goals. Trump had a ceasefire, didn't get it, threatened sanctions, didn't implement, and Putin, who just wanted to make sure everybody knew that he was back in the good graces of the President of the United States.
We know where President Macron from France is on this particular issue. What about the others, like Keir Starmer and Frederick Merz and Giorgia Meloni from Italy? Have there been any overt comments made by them? I mean, Macron has been very adamant that he doesn't like this wishy-washy approach that President Trump has been involved in with the Russians.
He has been perhaps the most outspoken, that's true. Of course, he's been the one that's been longest in office, if I recall. I mean, Starmer was elected in the last couple of years, Merz in the last few months. But they have shown, I think, surprising unity of purpose here in backing Ukraine and doing that now with the announcement of going to 5% of GDP on defense and also additional military and financial assistance being offered to the Ukrainians. And they've shown real unity of purpose, I think, that this is a European security question and not solely a Ukrainian security problem. And that if Putin is successful here, why would we think that this would be, you satisfy him forever? I mean, he has talked repeatedly about reestablishing, in many ways, the Russian Empire, if not the Soviet Union. And as a consequence, if you were part of the Baltic Republics, if you're Poland, any of those frontline states, Finland, for example, why would you be reassured if you give in to compromising him and providing this without extracting something in return, or at least some kind of a security guarantee? And last but not least, as I said before, I think the Europeans are very concerned about Mr. Putin so far being fairly skillful, I think, in using this issue of Ukraine to drive a wedge between the United States and its NATO allies. And what I think they fear the most is coming out of this meeting that either A, Mr. Trump will totally support the Russian position, or B, he will simply wash his hands of it and say, okay, I did the best I could. I was unable to get this accomplished, but then in reality, this is a European problem. This is your problem. Yes, we might sell you some weapons that you can then transfer to Ukraine if you want to, but the United States has no particular responsibility. Obviously, that would be disastrous for the Ukrainians, but I think even more worrisome, it would be disastrous for NATO.
Well, and disastrous for the United States, too, because
exactly.
Our word is worth nothing. I mean, I get the little caveat that you pointed out in 1991 because of the kind of puppet government leader of Putin in Ukraine.
You mean 2000?
But once that issue, once that issue was resolved, we still have the commitment to Ukraine, right? I mean, we're quick to fly around the world and make commitments, but it doesn't seem like we're quick to live up to them. And what Ukraine gave up going back to 1991 in the Budapest Memorandum was huge.
Right.
I mean,
they'd probably transfer. They probably wouldn't.
I don't know of a single other country, and I don't mean to interrupt, but I wanted to get your thought about that. I don't know of a single other country pre-war giving up what Ukraine has given up in maybe in the history of the world. I don't know.
No. Well, of course, nuclear weapons are fairly new, but certainly that's the case. And I've heard many Ukrainians say to me, well, we'll be happy to transfer this territory back to the Russians if they transfer those nuclear weapons back to us. Then we'll have our own guarantee. We won't need you guys, okay? Now, that's obviously with your tongue planted very firmly in your cheek. You know, but what is, the guarantees were written. But and furthermore, we, the United States, since the Second World War, have supported certain international norms. And those international norms have included that territory is not transferred through violence and military invasion. But that's an international norm that we, as a member of the international community, member of the Security Council of the UN, will not stand by. I went off and fought a war in 1990 and 91 in a place called Kuwait in Iraq. And why did we fight that war? Because a country, Iraq, invaded a sovereign country, Kuwait, and occupied all its territory and declared it part of Iraq, okay, which is pretty analogous to what we're talking about here. And we said, no, that will not stand. That cannot stand because that puts you in a world where the, back to the, you know, Melian dialogue in ancient Greece, where the strong do what they want and the weak do what they must. And that's not a world you and I want to live with for our grandkids.
Disappointing on many fronts. And like I said, I don't get all the issues and all the nuances, but, you know, if you don't have a word, if you can't defend your reputation and you're making these assurances to folks that are giving a lot up, when they call upon you, you got to be there some way, shape, or form. Colonel, as always, love the conversation with you. Colonel Jeff McCausland, CBS military analyst. Let's hope for something more positive coming out of today's meeting.
We'll see you about 3 o'clock today, Neil.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much. Have a great week. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us.
What's on your mind right now? The song you can't get out of your head? That breaking story? Or that conversation you just have to be a part of?
That's the brand new song from...
This is a breaking news report.
He shoots! He scores!
That's radio. Happening now. Connecting you to what matters most exactly when it's happening. From the airwaves to every device you stream on, radio is everywhere you are. It's local, live, and it's for you. Tag your favorite radio station tomorrow on social media and use hashtag National Radio Day to celebrate. That's hashtag National Radio Day.
Well, I obviously have an identity crisis. First, I'm a Trump sycophant, and that's what I've been blamed of. Now I suffer from Trump derangement syndrome because I am critical of the way that he handled this thing. And I've got a lot of people texting in saying, this is not our problem. Really? Well, we made guarantees in 1991. We made guarantees in 2014. We made it our problem the same way that we made it our problem in Israel, the same way we made it our problem in support of Kuwait with Iraq. This duplicity is not working well for me. It might work for you, but it's not working for me. Now, either we're going to live up to our commitments or not. And it should not be determined by how friendly and how conciliatory or complimentary we are of the president. Grow up, put your big pants on, and live up to the commitments that we've made to people. We'll be right back. We'll be right back after the top of the hour news break with Guy Williams, president, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. We'll talk about complications for the Federal Reserve rate cut and other issues as well. Stay with us.
What's on your mind right now? The song you can't get out of your head? That breaking story? Or that conversation you just have to be a part of?
That's the brand new song from...
This is a breaking news report.
He shoots! He scores!
That's radio. Happening now. Connecting you to what matters most exactly when it's happening. From the airwaves to every device you stream on, radio is everywhere you are. It's local, live, and it's for you. Tag your favorite radio station tomorrow on social media and use hashtag National Radio Day to celebrate. That's hashtag National Radio Day.